I think it's seven notes. Yeah, seven notes are exactly the same. Exactly the same. He just copied it.
Before the Rings of Power, there were the Silmarils. Before Sauron, there was his master Morgoth. Before Aragorn and Arwen, there was Beren and Lúthien. Join us as we explore Tolkien and all the ages of Middle-earth with your hosts from theonering.com, Jonathan Watson and Michael Grumbine.
Michael, did you know that music is the soundtrack of our lives? And it's also the music is also the soundtrack of movies. Did you know that?
That sounds like something from
Mystery Men.
Okay.
Sorry. No. I don't know. It's not from Mystery Men. What does it sound like? Sorry.
Well, it sounds like it's something on a calendar that you'd buy from the 80s or something like that.
Yeah. No, music is the anyway. So we're talking about Howard Shore here a little bit. We have from 2003 the roundtable interviews that I was a part of right before The Return of the King came out. And we've got this great interview with Howard Shore. I think it's one of the more interesting ones, particularly at the end, in my opinion. And we'll get into that. Yes. Wait till the end. The teaser.
I think I know.
Yeah. Because it was a question like I had to, as they say in Shakespeare, I had to screw my courage to the sticking place and actually like ask the question. And I did it right at the end, right as he was getting up to leave. And he wasn't happy.
Jonathan Watson, making famous composers uncomfortable since 2003.
The 27-year-old Jonathan Watson doing that now. No, yeah, whew, that was fun. Anyway, so we're talking about Howard Shore. We're gonna get into it after you hear. It's about 22 minutes or so that we speak with him, or that I speak with him and other people. We get the standard questions. You guys have heard the other ones about the Shire. They're all in there. I'm so sorry.
Ugh.
But I will say the quality of this episode is awesome. And thank you again to Fra, who did our intro, and he took this and ran it through some magical AI audio tool that makes it sound amazing compared to what it is. So it's the best sounding audio yet of our interviews. It gets a little weird sometimes because it takes the S's and makes them sound like they're lisping, like they're saying the TH's, right? Like the Castilian or something like that. And just ignore that. And sometimes it doesn't know what somebody, I think, who is from either Mexico or like Costa Rica or something, like from a newspaper there, it has no clue what he's saying. So I'm going to try and fix that with some post-production, whether with captions or not. But we'll listen in. I hope it sounds great. And then afterwards in our extended podcast, which is for our members at theonering.com/member for $4 a month. And in fact, I have a Patreon now. I set up Patreon. You can go to theonering.com/Patreon or patreon.com/theonering.com. It's not listed here, but because I'm still making sure and figuring things out. But it's all hooked up now. So you can go to Patreon, patreon.com/theonering.com. I'm going to make sure that that's right. But yeah, but go there. And what you can do is you can pay there if you're already a Patreon member without having to put in your credit card information and doing all that. The only thing is that it is $1 more for members. And, which is just because they take so much of the payment, right? So it's so much of the payment. No, it's not patreon.com, the One Ring. So go to theonering.com/Patreon and that'll push you right to the Patreon page. But if you want to get it for $4 a month and you get the whole first month free, where you can get the extended podcast where we're going to be talking about what our favorite songs are from the Lord of the Rings soundtracks, both in the themes and in the singles that came out. There were three of them. And we'll also talk about what our least favorite is. I have one that's counterculture to what a lot of people think, or what a lot of people like. Like, I've never liked it. That's the weird thing. What you're going to find out in going through this here is I'm not a huge fan of this soundtrack. We'll talk about it.
So you're living up to our grumpy reputation already.
Oh yeah.
Starting out. Yep.
Same. There are a lot of people who understand why I hate like certain parts of the movie and things like that. But when it comes to the music, they're like, "You what?" I'm like, "I don't hate the music. It just doesn't do much for me." So we'll talk about why in the extended podcast, maybe a little bit after the fact too about why. But we'll get into more details about that. So go to theonering.com/member. It's free for a month. If you go to theonering.com/Patreon, it's free for 1 week. So you get way more if you become a member at theonering.com. Give it a shot. Thanks, everybody. All right. We'll jump into...
And again, thank you, Fra.
Yes, absolutely. It sounds amazing. Let's jump into this interview with Howard Shore from December 2003.
tell us, I'm sorry, can you never tell us a little bit about the specific extra scoring for the Exhibit DVD?
Each year we do an extended version of the film,
right.
Of the theatrical version, and I do a complete production of composition, orchestration, conducting. We do a complete recording. It is an actual movie. I mean, I did many movies before Lord of the Rings. Each Lord of the Rings film, I think, is comparable to six film production for me. Mm-hmm. And the DVD is the seventh. And we really, you know, I mean, it's as much work and as much involvement in the DVD as doing any other film I ever did in Hollywood, and just on the DVD.
And why is that exactly?
Just the detail and our process and the way we've created the movies, and you probably see that on the screen, like how much detail and DVD is a complicated thing as well, because you're taking an existing film that's been mastered and you're opening it up and creating new pieces, right? You know, and you want it to feel seamlessly, because we think the extended versions will be the historical version of these films in years from now. So we want the extended version is the thing we really could kind of want to be great, because we think that will be the one that will really live on.
Do you actually rescore when you have to do the insertions where there's an extra 20 seconds?
Absolutely.
You rescore the whole thing, or do you rescore? Wow.
Yeah. Well, I find a good endpoint and an endpoint. So, you know, wherever that is in the phrase. And it's like photography, where you're going back and you have to relight specifically the scene, because you have to create it in the same image. So we go back to the same studios. We have very specific miking imagery that we use, or same instruments, same players. It's all very mathematical, scientific, to create the same sound for the film. So when we put it in, it has this, you know, the very seamless quality to it, as if we made that film as well as making the theatrical. It's a cool thing to do. It's really hard, detailed work, but it's really, really cool. We love doing it.
It's a bit of a song when the king tells Murray to stand up there and to sing something. Did you choose that key?
Which one? Aragorn?
Yeah.
The
Hobbit
singing. The Hobbit singing. It sounds like an old Irish folk.
Where they bow to Mary. The
singing it.
Right, and it's at the same point where Faramir is leading the guys against the orc, and they get slaughtered. The big slaughtered.
Right.
John Noble.
Oh, you're talking about Billy Boyd's song.
Right.
Billy Boyd. Pippin's song.
Pippin's song.
No, that's Pippin. They're talking lyrics. Billy, that's Billy's melody. And he sang it on set. Yeah, no, that's Billy. That was done before I even had started. I heard about that song. And it wasn't a
actually, that is the Return of the King that I thought was fantastic.
Billy, no, that's Billy. Yeah, that's beautiful. And then I did just the back. I did the pieces of the horses riding into it, and you know, but that's completely Billy's thing. Yeah.
Were there any influences that you had? For instance, a few that come to mind. George Lucas played Holst the Planet for John Williams before he scored Star Wars. Was there any influence, or was there any sort of thing in mind that Peter Jackson had before you actually started scoring the entire film?
We didn't really listen to anything really specifically, but you have to remember, Middle Earth is 5,000 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So we wanted to create a culture based on this world that was the beginning of European culture, if you will. So we used Celtic music, which is one of the oldest music in the world. Kind of all the score is kind of steeped in 19th century symphonic tradition. The singing was important because of its just healing quality, you know, the idea of using voices and of using the Tolkien languages. So you wanted to create a historical piece that felt as if it was 5,000 years ago. And that was the idea. And that if you feel influences now from it, the idea was to create something that was old, and that things would have grown out of. So European music may have grown out of this tradition of this sound from Middle Earth. That was kind of the idea for the score.
kind of makes any of
that and the Peter's great sense of classic movie making, you know, of epic movie making. He really understood that. And how do you know, Lord of the Rings has 40-50 motifs in it. He understood that kind of architecture to it. And there's, you know, motifs created for culture and for characters and for objects. And he understood that really well. And that, you know, things had to have particular sounds to it. And we wanted to create a sense of reality to the movies in the music. So when you were in Lothlorien or Rivendell, it had very specific feeling composition to it, and the use of the indigenous instruments that might have been used in those plays was like the Hardinger fiddle used in Rohan, because Tolkien described it as a Viking Nordic culture and things like that. But we also, this was very, very important to Peter, that it also held a story, because the story of Lord of the Rings is dense. People haven't read the book. We wanted to create a movie that people could just watch, and they would have references, and they would understand that Galadriel was in Lothlorien because this music had a part of that character. You heard, you know, the monochord and the sarangi, you know, connected to certain. So it helped you to understand the story, because it's complicated. In Return of the King, there's, you know, when they're forging the sword, Narsil is being forged to Andoril, which is a really significant event in the movie, because only through the reforging is Aragorn able to become king. Elrond, you have a sword. And you have to understand that the sword came from Rivendell. You have to understand in Return of the King that Elrond and Arwen are in Rivendell. So there's certain orchestrational things that I would do, certain companies, you know, to make, put you back at Rivendell. Yeah. Things like that. The music was used in a way for clarity of a storytelling, so you understood it. And so there had to be linkages for clarity, you know, but then there had to be a lot of new creation, too, because you're going to new worlds. You're going to Gondor. You're meeting Faramir and Denethor and Path of the Dead, Shelob.
In this last movie, how many times did you hear Peter say the word tension?
That'd be good, buddy. Yeah, that's right. You're spooky. This is gonna feel spooky. I know. There's quite a lot of it, isn't it? It's kind of building on top of each other. I know.
Well, it's the nature of it. Yeah. I mean, it's just a story that does keep building. I mean, there was a point, and I knew it was gonna come when you're writing. I mean, it's a very iconic movie, Return of the King. And there is a moment when you're writing the destruction of the ring. And you know it's coming. I mean, you've read the book and everything, and you've read it many times. But there were those great moments where you had to write that piece, and you had to do the pieces leading up to it. There is that moment where, you know, it's Sam and Frodo on Mount Doom, and, you know, and it's all building towards the climax, you know, of the destruction of the ring.
Do you have any favorite theme?
Well, I think for Sam Frodo, I think that relationship is important to me.
I mean, musically speaking.
Well, there's just, I think the relation to the Shire and just elements of the Shire and in dreams, certainly. And, you know, that the things really related to them. In terms of specifically to Return of the King, Gondor is a favorite. And, you know, the relationship of Denethor and Faramir is
pretty interesting to me, musically.
What kind of priest
do you do? A lot for Lord of the Rings. I mean, I had done literary adaptions before. I did Naked Lunch, based on William Burroughs, and J.G. Ballard's Crash, and Looking for Richard, based on Richard III, Shakespeare. And so doing Lord of the Rings, Tolkien, I mean, it's a pretty big undertaking. And I did easily 4 months of research before I even felt comfortable writing a note. I have to do that. And the research is a way for me to get away from the piece intellectually. Because music is not intellectual to me. It's an emotional thing. So you can't write unless you're, for me, to research means intellectually, you've absorbed enough of this thing, you know. So to look at Tolkien, you have to look at what Tolkien was influenced by Industrial Revolution came, you know, the country in England, the First World War. You have to understand all that. You have to understand Tolkien's influences up to the time that you're writing, Lord of the Rings, published in 1954. So you have to understand what happened in 50 years. You know, what is he influenced with all these other things in literature, film, and music. So you look at all that, and then you put that all away. Never look at it. You have to, you know, Ring mythology, put it all away. And then you say, okay, what is this little hobbit going to do? Like, what are you going to do? Because you have to be comfortable with your own means of expression. But you won't be comfortable with it unless you've done the intellectual research. You go, okay, all right, I understand this. Now, what's your expression about this? Man. So that's really all that it is. The same with those other things, you know, with Burroughs and, you know, and Ballard. You have to understand it. And if, well, what, now what are you going to say about it?
I wanted to ask about the Shire. You mentioned about the theme to it. And yeah. I want to find out, what is your idea of the Shire? What is that safe place or that happy place that you would like to go back to?
We always thought New Zealand was the Shire, and I think New Zealand had a major influence on everybody creating the movie. And I grew up in Canada, in Toronto, and I had toured a lot through Canada. So actually, going to New Zealand felt very Canadian to me, and I understood it well. And it's a part of the Commonwealth and all that. And but New Zealand always felt like the Shire to us. And it's got the Kiwi spirit is prevalent in the movie. It's such an important part of what we love about Lord of the Rings, about Peter Jackson's love of Lord of the Rings, because we love it too. And the Kiwi sensibility is a huge thing about what's great about it. And that's a very Shire type expression to me. Is they talk to you about King Kong? Sure, yeah, I talked to Peter, but now I'm going to work. You're going to do it? Oh, sure, yeah. So what's the work with Peter again on the movie? What's the concept? Well, King Kong, well, I mean, the music. to be the concept, yeah. No, that comes a little later. Yeah. No, we're still into researching and you know, we're not into that yet. Mm-hmm. So we have to shoot the movie.
Yeah. Avoiding DeLorenzo's version.
No, I'm not avoiding or looking. You know, I'm not really thinking that. No. You know, that all comes a little later. You have to do the research. Same thing. You know, you've got to study what led up to it. And we met Ray Harryhausen. Mm-hmm. They came to one of the sessions in London, and you know, you do go through the same process. You know, you look at the films and what, the expression of it, and what people did, and then you work with Peter. You look at what Peter's going to do. Hey, he's a great filmmaker, and you know, you work with him. We're very collaborative, Peter and I.
Mm-hmm.
We're good friends. We work really well together. Like we work well, like writers, basically right. together. Even though you're writing music, you're working with him in a very great way where you really, you know, he's guiding you in terms of the expression of it, you know, step by step.
How much music does he know? I mean, does he talk in music terms with you?
He talks the best way, I think, because I've worked with a lot of really good directors, and the best way is really just to work the way you would work with an actor.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, it'll be because you're composing, but you're also conducting. Conducting is a form of expression. You know, it's a moment in time where something happens. And Peter's at those moments. So he's helping you shape the performance. And he's saying that it could grow here. It could be bigger here. It could be more expressive. He also knows the great Tate, Peter. He knows when the orchestra is just doing the great thing.
Okay.
And he'll say to you, that's it, you have it, go do that. You know, I mean, he's just a great guide for you as an actor. You know, if you were an actor, he would show, you know, lead you up to the moment where you do the really good take, and then that's it. And however directors do that, whatever magic they do with an actor to get it, he does the same with his collaborator. Does it with everybody. I always think it's a great way to work.
Put on the soundtrack and enjoy it. You sit down to read a book and you put on the music. What is it that people will hear that, let's say, it's unusual or that will stand out in your mind that you just hope that they'll say, wow.
Okay, this piece.
Yeah.
Lighting of the Beacon, I'm pretty proud of. I'm very proud of the destruction of the ring, I think it is all pretty cool. The choir, and just the contrast of the, it goes from 200 piece orchestra to one singer. You know, this beautiful contrast. I think Renee Fleming, local, they're outstanding. And she does four iconic pieces in the film. She does reforging of Narsil, the Rivendell scene. She does Gollum finally getting the ring, which is an amazing moment because you've been waiting for Gollum to get the ring for quite a long time. She does the eagle scene where the eagles come and pick up. She does that aria there, which I love. It kills me every time I hear her sing that. And then she does the Arwen at the coronation, which is just incredibly beautiful. And Galway, James Galway, plays beautiful whistle, tin whistle, and boot solo. And the song killed me. You know, Annie Lennox's vocal on Into the Wet. It's beautiful.
So the whole soundtrack.
Dermot Crean plays the solo. I love the soloists are great. Dermot Crean plays an amazing solo when the hobbits return to the Shire and they go to the pub. Do you remember that scene? He played that fiddle. It's so sad. It kills me. And it's so beautiful. And it's that moment where they know they've gone back to the Shire, but things are not really the same. They've changed. But everybody else is the same. I love that.
Great. Well, one thing you'll keep your own.
It's at home, living room. Just in the living room at home.
Are you disappointed that you can't be, because of the ruling that no sequels will now be allowed as a separate soundtrack?
Well, I don't think there is an actual ruling.
Really?
Actually. No. I think they were thinking about it.
Oh, really? All right. And as far as I know, we're okay. We're
good.
Yeah, we're okay this year. We can.
Yeah.
Good area.
It ought to be no. The thing would be the big nominal coming tonight. Oh, yeah.
Well, I'd love to see Peter recognized. I think he's done amazing work, and if anybody deserves that kind of recognition, he really does. Just from the work he's done on the three films, well, pretty unbelievable. And it's kind of landmark in movies. It'd be wonderful to see Peter recognized in movies. It'd be great.
Yeah.
I'm hoping. What? Is it just the marketing department comes up with the idea of, like, using Requiem for a Dream soundtrack on the previews, or how does that happen?
Well, that's an ad thing. Yeah, they didn't do it on this movie, but they used it on, yeah. Lord of the Rings is such a closed world in terms of the culture, but and I think that was the confusion on it, because the trailers rarely use the music from the movie. But Lord of the Rings is so sort of scrutinized that the fact that it had some other music on it was like, well, what's this music, you know? And in fact, trailer companies do that all the time.
Right.
It's like a normal kind of thing. So they just used a piece of music. I mean, they use my music on other trailers, you know, from other movies.
Well,
But the piece is not in the movie, and it's not connected to the movie. It's just part of the advertising in the movie, which is done very sort of closed, you know, like a contract given to a trailer company. They have to deliver a trailer and the soundtrack, you know. So they just do it themselves. You don't really
have any real info on what they do that with separately contracted thing.
On this film, however, I did the trailer. And I did it because of that. Mm-hmm. Because it created so much confusion. Mm-hmm. So I said, well, I'll just do them. And I had done them on other movies. I mean, Tim Burton done them on. Well, yeah, I've done on Ed Wood. We used all the music. I'm just done.
I mean, I prefer that, obviously, but sometimes you just don't have anything for, you know, it's not really in your realm of control.
For your recall, nights of your major influence of the composer.
When I grew up, I discovered Takemitsu, Tora Takemitsu, and it's still a pretty big influence, and I love his music, and he did movie soundtracks and work with Kurosawa, and I also discovered, this is when I was a teenager, and those were pretty big influence, was Ornette Coleman and improvisation. And I love the idea of expressing ideas based on immediate feelings that you had. So I use those techniques to do composition, you know, film composition is based on seeing something, feeling something, and through a form of improvisation, however you want to call it, it's just an expression of what you feel musically, and that's how I write. Well,
but those are pretty big important.
Okay. You always that wanted question? Okay, you always wanted to write for a movie, not a music card?
I was interested in music more than I was in movies, actually. And when I started doing movies in the late 70s, it was really a way to express myself musically, because I didn't have orchestras or chamber orchestras or jazz, anybody to work with. Really, I had a lot of ideas, but the music became a way, I mean, films became a way just to express music. And this piece has been the most expressive. You know, it's been over 20 years for me writing, and then now you have this work, you know, symphony orchestra and chorus and soloist, and it used every expression that I had learned, really, about drama and music. So it was sort of a culmination, really, to the work.
Okay, thank you for the horn. And thank you.
How good. And thank
you. Okay. Have you, out of curiosity, have you ever heard the hymn, "This Is My Father's World"?
No, I don't.
Yeah. Because there's an eerie similarity between that and the Hobbit scene at times.
Right. Oddly enough, we didn't get the soundtrack in our bag.
So that was Howard Shore with a unique ending question, which we'll get into at the tail end of our of this episode. Because I'll say, when I asked him about "This Is My Father's World," that was the first thing I heard when I heard anything from the soundtrack, was he copied a hymn, which led me into a lot of alleyways that a lot of people don't like when it comes to how I appreciate the soundtrack or don't appreciate the soundtrack. Anyway, we'll get into it. Michael, what did you notice about this interview with Howard Shore? What stood out to you?
Many things. So I'll go to the beginning, I guess, first. One of the things that was I thought was really cool, and I hadn't known before, was that they, when they did the extended edition, they re-recorded everything. And that was, you know, they're adding something. In some cases, you know, you got a scene in the movie that they got to match music to, and the scene's, whatever, 20 seconds longer than the movie. The extended version scene, I mean, is 20 seconds longer than the movie. And they just they redid the whole thing. They would sit through with the orchestra and do everything again. I guess, right?
Is that's it, what it sounded like? At least for the parts where there were extended, like 20 seconds of additional footage,
right.
That they would go back and he had to rewrite it and they had to re-record it, because you can't just like splice in 20 seconds where you've got an entire orchestra playing. That's
right.
Even AI can't do that.
But related to that, more importantly to me, because I'm an historian by nature anyway, if not by profession, because it doesn't pay anything, so just by nature. Also. the Howard Shore was made a point of talking about how he thinks the extended edition versions are what he called the historical version, the one that's going to really live on, as he said. And
yes.
And I totally agree. Like we don't even watch the cinematic versions at our house, except, you know, when they come to the movie theater 20 years later and we're doing the repeat,
yeah,
then, which
for sure.
we did recently, but we just watched the extended edition, and to the point where I sometimes get confused because I can't remember what wasn't in the extended edition at certain points. It was cool that Howard Shore sees them that way. He sees them as the extended editions as the things that we're really living on. And he was focused on that in this interview because, of course, this is right before the release of The Return of the King, but he's doing the extended editions for the first two movies already. And so, you know.
And that's actually separate from what Peter Jackson said. Peter Jackson said that the definitive editions are the film editions, and the extended editions were, quote, for the fans. And so he never said, "This is my definitive edition." He said, "We just did it because the fans really wanted it," which I don't know if I totally buy, because that might have been he had to speak for the studio in that sense. But he was in touch with the fans a lot. So I would say,
and they put a lot of work into those extended editions too. Oh. So his yeah. his words are belied by his work in that point. So yeah. I tend towards Howard Shore's opinion on those matters. So that was the first and coolest thing that I noticed about the interview. How about you?
I thought it was interesting when he talks about everything that goes into the research for writing something like this. He said that he used the word Celtic at times, but he also talked about, you know, all the composers from the 1800s. And he said, you bring it all together, all those things that you need to research in order to understand the film. And then you put it all aside and you see what comes out after that. So it's sort of like you bathe in this, right? And then what's left after that? Or you have all these ingredients and you know how each one tastes separately. But when you put it all together and it sits in an oven without seeing them for 40 minutes, like something totally different comes out. And I think that's for those who really like the soundtrack, that's what makes it unique, is that there is a sense of this is something new and different that has never been done before.
Right.
With the types of instruments he used, with the types of vocalizations that he used, and the different languages too, he didn't shy away from using Kuzdul or the Black Speech or Elven, right? All those were in there. And so it makes something greater, and it speaks to, like you said, historically, being historical, respecting the past and using that instead of throwing in, I mean, Chariots of Fire was a great soundtrack, but somehow it still just doesn't fit with that movie. You know?
Yeah, yeah. That's what's so crazy is like the title of the movie Chariots of Fire and the music seem like they're written for a different movie than what the actual movie is.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Whereas this one, it fits very well with the film. I think the soundtrack is far better with the film than it is listening to it separate as its own entity.
Totally agree. And what I liked about that section that you were just referencing was he mentioned that he went for 4 months researching the life of Tolkien and getting everything before he wrote a single note.
You know what's crazy about that? That's 3 months and 30 days longer than they did for the Rings of Power in the amount of research.
Maybe 3 months and 31 days longer. So, yeah, there's no argument there. It's really cool. I have to say, I found it very endearing. He had this one line that I think a lot of maybe people missed, or they misunderstood, or maybe we just couldn't see the reaction. You were in the room, so maybe you can tell me. But he had this line when he was talking about that. He said, after doing all that, he said music is primarily an emotional thing, but he felt like he had to intellectually understand Tolkien first, and he had to feed his intellect, and then put it all aside, like you said, and go for the music. But then at the end of it, he said his reaction was, what can this hobbit do? And he was talking about himself. He said, like, after immersing himself in the world of Tolkien, he sees himself as, what can this the hobbit do? Which is, of course, I think very apropos, because that's part of one of the major themes in Tolkien's work, is the idea that, you know, even the very small and insignificant have a role to play, but they don't have any illusions about the fact that they remain small and insignificant on a certain level, even if their purpose is larger ultimately. And so the fact that he identified himself with the hobbit at that point, like in the face of this greatness of Tolkien, I thought that was cool.
Yeah, he even has, he was asked about what his favorite songs are from there. So clearly he loves certain things about it. And right. He was able to say two songs, which one was clear, Lighting of the Beacons. He sent that one. And there's a ton of folks who absolutely love that song. I think it's the greatest song on the soundtrack. I know some people personally who do. And the second one he said is The Destruction of the Ring, which I was like, oh, I've never really
not referenced much.
Yeah. Because it's not like a theme so much as, a sense, as a feeling, right? He's going for the destruction. And I love the point that he makes, like it goes from this bombastic, crazy, like the earth is exploding, to just one person singing.
Right.
In a note. And when I re-listen to it, I'm like, yeah, that's pretty good. That's impressive.
I did think about that. I didn't re-listen to that one. I did re-listen to Lighting of the Beacons after he said that. And Lighting of the Beacons I'd always thought was decent, but it didn't grab my heart. But I listened to it again, and I think I got a slightly greater appreciation for what he's doing in there. I was trying to sort of follow the thread, and he has a kind of juxtaposition between grand themes and minor themes, where he kind of soars back and forth. And at a certain point, it's almost as like he's following the line of the White Mountains, which of course is the visual in the Lighting of the Beacons. So
yeah, and I've never really enjoyed the Lighting of the Beacons because it's kind of repetitive, in my opinion. And that was why I really enjoy. If it's going to be repetitive, it better be some ambient stuff that it's just in the background, not forefront. And it's not. It just didn't strike me as something tremendous. I thought his other themes were far more impressive. I mean, I do like the Hobbit's theme. I think it's well done. And so, yeah, it didn't strike me as my favorite one. But okay, so speaking about themes.
The moment of discomfort has come.
So the very first time I remember, and I will say exactly where, I was on a temporary job working at Southern California Edison. And I got in my hands on the pre-release of the very first song. I think it was either released or somebody had emailed it to me at the point of what concerning Hobbits, the very first song they were going to release was going to sound like. And our first taste, this was in, I would guess, summer 2001, probably maybe early like spring or something like that. And I listened to it. And the very first thing I hear, growing up Presbyterian, this was something I knew well, was a hymn called This Is My Father's World. Those first, I think it's seven notes. Da, 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 da. Yeah, seven notes are exactly the same as This Is My Father's World. And that probably ruined me and my love of the soundtrack, because my first impression was he just copied it. It's a pastoral hymn. It talks about a father's world that, like, here, I'll read you some of the lyrics of it. This is my father's world, and to my listening ears, all nature sings, and round me rings the music of the spheres. This is my father's world. I rest me in the thought of rocks and trees, of skies and seas, his hand the wonders wrought. And it's very pastoral, and the hobbits are very pastoral. So it just struck me as weird. And if you don't believe me, I'll give you two reasons why they're exactly the same. One, Wikipedia says so. If you go to This Is My Father's World, the link for that on Wikipedia actually has a note. He quoted the first seven notes of the hymn verbatim in his Shire theme. And two, if you don't listen to me, here you go. Or if you don't listen to me, if you don't believe me, here you go. So yeah, so it's exactly the same seven notes. The first one is concerning hobbits. The second one, I think you're muted, Michael, is This Is My Father's World. And I'll play it one more time just so that you know I'm not fibbing. This is what I heard, and I could not stand that he copied the exact same seven notes from a well-known hymn that had been over 125 years old. All right, here we go. Now there is a similarity to the second stanza as well. It's not the same. There's a similarity. I couldn't put it in here because YouTube will throw us off because of its copyright claim for the Concerning Hobbits song. But it's very, very similar. And so when I went to Howard Shore and I saw him, I'm like, well, I'm going to ask him. I'm going to actually ask him. And it took me a while. I couldn't do it in the middle of it. I felt weird saying it in front of everybody else, like accusing him of copying a well-known hymn. Hey, he could copy it. It was in the public domain. So I asked it at the very end if he had ever, you know, I had said it has a striking resemblance or an eerie resemblance. I can't remember the exact words that he used. Similarity to This Is My Father's World. Have you ever heard of that before? He's like, oh, no, I didn't. And then he turns around and he goes, like, his face changed from like, oh, I'm talking to these people, to what in the world did he just ask me? He knew. He knew, man. He knew that this was from that hymn. And he was probably he's Canadian. He probably didn't grow up in a church. He probably didn't think many people knew the song, but no, it's exactly the same thing. And this is the reason why I think you would have a really hard time with the whole soundtrack, because the first taste of it was such a bad flavor. It was not good. Anyway, maybe I'm over the top on this and I should have given him a lot more.
I think it's awesome. Grace. Like this is a premium The OneRing.com experience, because you have information that they're basically what there were 20 other people that have that experience, mm-hmm. in the world. And I thought it was hilarious. you know, I was reminded to be, I'm trying to be charitable to Howard Shore, and which I think we should be. He's an artist. He's a tremendously creative and impressive artist, and so, and composer. And so my theory is he probably heard it and did, like you said, had no appreciation for that. The fact that this was an in-use hymn, you know, the fact that it's so old means that he probably, it was probably one of those things that he was like looking back at 19th century music and the time that Tolkien grew up. Cause he talked about researching Tolkien's life and everything. So I could see that this kind of music, and he's looking at Celtic music and this has a Celtic feel to it. And so in my opinion, he probably was, he probably picked it up as something that, and he doesn't copy the whole song concerning hobbits. It's not
primarily the same songs.
It just has that one theme, which is unfortunately the primary theme and probably one of the three most popular motifs from Lord of the Rings. Maybe the most popular. Well, the main theme is probably, you know,
And so I wish you would have just said, yeah, I had heard it. I thought it was a wonderful little part, and I thought tying in that idea of a pastoral hymn with a pastoral hobbit.
I don't think he thought he'd ever get caught with that one.
Yeah, you're probably right. And so I was just like, oh man, come on, dude.
But I don't know. But for me, because composers take so much from others and weave it into their pieces, and Tolkien himself, like that's what Tolkien did. What's Gandalf? He's directly from a Nordic myth. Like he's a character. You know, there's so many direct yanks that Tolkien did. I don't even care that much, but I think it's funny that you caught him and his reaction was so.
It was so obvious. Like obviously he heard it, he looked at me, no, and he turned and started talking to somebody else instantly. It was just like, he wouldn't acknowledge me anymore, even though I was sitting right next to him the whole time. And yeah,
that's funny.
Yeah. Anyway, anything else? Any other final notes? I mean, here's the, I want to make sure, like, I'm not taking away from Howard Shore and his incredible talent in writing this soundtrack. Right. It was just the very first thing I heard from any music for the Lord of the Rings ever in the history of the world was me with headphones on hearing This Is My Father's World and thinking he copied that. And it was just, it just leaves a bad taste. There's so much originality in the rest of it that it's a little disappointing that it's exactly the same to me. And I can't get rid of that disappointment even these 20 some years later.
Speaking on that theme, this is my final note to this for this non-member section. Speaking on that theme, James Galway, who is probably one of the greatest Irish musicians of all time.
Mm-hmm. I know his name.
He was the one that played the tin whistle for that theme. And it was years before the Lord of the Rings was ever a thing that James Galway inspired me to learn the Irish tin whistle, listening to Irish music. And I'm trying to woo my wife, who's an Irish musician. So I had to try to prove that I could. So as a part of that from 1995 and 96, well before there were any Lord of the Rings movies, I was learning the tin whistle to James Galway. And so hearing James Galway in, you know, playing the theme was really cool to me. And being a good Catholic, I had no idea that this was a Protestant hymn that was,
I know, right? Yeah. So you were safe from it. You were safe.
So it wasn't tainted. It wasn't tainted in my mind. It was just James Galway playing the Irish, the tin whistle for this beautiful little Celtic motif that to my mind, Howard Shore had done a good job inventing, or as it actually turns out, yanking.
Let's not forget that some of the greatest songs of all time have used riffs from other songs. For instance, you know, You Can't Touch This by MC Hammer. The whole thing's a cop.
So that's what makes it into your greatest songs of all times list? Or Vanilla Ice.
Or Vanilla Ice. Yeah, exactly. Look at all this stuff. No. I mean, look, I do like the soundtrack. I do enjoy listening to it. It's just not my favorite. And we'll get into more details of that, of why that is, in our extended podcast for members at thewonery.com/member or thewonery.com/Patreon.
All right, that's it for us today. Goodbye, freeloaders.